My flight instructor had been transferred, and I had been assigned, all of the students had, to a new man, a guy by the name of Lieutenant Wells. I had liked the previous instructor, Lieutenant Hodges, very well, but I quickly decided that I liked Lieutenant Wells a great deal better. In the first place, he was more serious, and he was not afraid of flying with students, and he never seemed to get terribly upset about things. And it wasn't as though he was just sort of easygoing. He wasn't. He just took a broad view of everything and was not easily flappable. But anyway, I remember that when I came back from the hospital and Lieutenant Wells took me up on an instrument flight, and it was a rather sorry affair, in my own opinion. And also, in Lieutenant Wells' opinion, evidently, because when we came back and were walking into the ready room from the flight line, he said to me, is that the way you usually fly? And I said, no, sir, it isn't. And he said, I hope to God it isn't. And that gave me a few bad moments. But the next time we went flying, when we came in, he looked at me and said, well, that's more like it. And so that little episode was over. I ought to say something at this point about formation flying. I don't know how they teach that nowadays, probably the same way they always did, but when I was learning it, you learned to fly extremely close to the airplane next to you, and the basic cardinal rule was, and had to be, you kept your eyes glued on the wingtip of the plane you were following, and you didn't take your eyes off of that wingtip, no matter what. And you tried to maintain your position in relation to it, and not run into him or let him run into you or get too far behind or too far out or too far up or too far down. And you got on to that eventually, but it always involved a constant amount of throttle jockeying and this and that. But we got good enough at it that we would go up with four airplanes, or three, I don't remember which, at a time. And I remember on more than one occasion when we landed three planes at a time in formation. And I had no inkling that we were landing at all, going to land at all. The first thing I knew was that I could see grass under his wingtip, and then I felt the wheels touch the ground, and there we were. I know that I said Shaw Field had paved runways, and they did, but the formation landings were done on a huge big grass strip which adjoined the paved portions of the field. Night flying wasn't all that difficult, and the cross-country flying was great fun. I enjoyed that hugely, and always got a big kick out of it. When it was about time to finish up at Shaw Field, I did a thing which was, I can only remember with great embarrassment even today. I guess I had finished my flying and went up for the final flight to finish out the number of hours or whatever. And like a damned fool, I saw fit to fly over to the Muiz's house over in Sumter, which was in the town, and do all kinds of stupid stunts over the house, loops and rolls and God knows what else, and probably fairly close to the ground. They told me later that they were so frightened they were about to call the field and ask them to do something about it. Fortunately, they didn't, because if they had, that would have been the end of it. End of me, as far as flying was concerned. But thanks again to my guardian angel, I didn't get caught at this idiotic performance, and somehow got away with it. Somewhere along the line at Shaw Field, I had struck up a friendship with a young fella about my own age. I don't remember his last name. His first name was Herbert. And he was a very quiet, gentle youngster. And very sensitive, I think. He played the violin, I remember. Though I'm not sure that I ever heard him play it. Anyway, both of us detested athletics. And we found out that we could, when we went out on the athletic field, we just sort of spun off in another direction and went into some woods nearby and sat around and talked until the time was up, and then went back to the barracks, and nobody ever caught us doing this. So we got away with, both of us, with not doing much in the way of athletics at all while we were there. It's a wonder somebody didn't see us one time or another. Maybe they did, but nobody that mattered saw us, because we never got caught at it. Anyway, when the time came to go then down to advanced flying school, of course, the cadets were assigned to various advanced flying schools around the southeastern United States. But this time, whereas everybody practically, if not everybody entirely, at primary flight school was transferred for basic training to Shaw Field, the transfer from basic flying school to advanced flying school was another matter, because at that point somebody in your life, and nobody ever knew who or cared again, made the decision as to whether you were going to go to a twin engine school, which pretty well meant whether you were going to become a bomber pilot, or whether you would go to single engine school, which would mean that you were going to become a fighter pilot or an instructor, one or the other. There were a number of twin engine advanced schools scattered over Georgia, mostly. Probably some in Louisiana and probably some in Florida, I don't know. Most of the people that I knew personally who were transferred to twin engine school for advanced flying went to Albany, Georgia. And most of the people that I knew who were slated to go to single engine flying school went down to a place in Moultrie, spelled Moultrie, Georgia, which is down in south central Georgia, to a place called Spence Field, S-P-E-N-C-E. Spence Field, like Shaw Field, was a brand new field, and again, we were the second class ever to go there. It was a big place, and I had known a guy, gotten to know a guy at Shaw Field by the name of Elliot Black. Elliot Black was a bit of a wag and a very nice youngster. I remember one time when at Shaw Field I was taxiing out to take off, and there were a number of airplanes in front of me also taxiing out to take off. And of course, we weren't all that recognizable with the helmet and goggles and all that stuff on and But I did know that the airplane in front of me, that Elliot Black was in it. And so when I thought he was not quite ready for this, I picked up the microphone and said over the air, "Watch it, Black." And I had the desired results. He squirmed around the cockpit and looked in every direction and all, but he never did recognize me. And but I could see it really made him nervous, and I was tremendously pleased with my little stupid joke. Anyway, Elliot Black had a car, and he asked me and a fellow, I think, by the name of Bill Fawcett, and my friend Herbert. I wish I could remember his last name, but I can't. But you should keep his name in mind, because he'll come up again later. Anyway, I think the four of us drove down, Black and Fawcett and me. Maybe it was somebody else, but I know it was Black and Herbert and me. And I, whatever. We drove down in Black's car. And there was no story attached to that. Again, there was an upper class at Spence Field, but again with a 7-day-a-week schedule. We barely laid eyes on those people, and before we were half done, they had left anyway. So they were no hazard. I forget what our quarters were like at Spence Field. They were regular army barracks, though, and probably exactly the same as at Shaw, except I don't remember having two roommates. Must have had one. But who that was, I don't remember. Some of my friends were still there, though. Charlie Smith was there. Joe Hensler was there. Snuffy Smith was there. Incidentally, there was another Snuffy amongst us. I should mention him, because he remained in my life for the next couple of years. He was one of the second lieutenants who was a flying trainee. And his last name was Dordan, D-O-O-R-D-A-N. And he was a strange-looking, sort of dwarfish, elfin-looking character. And for some reason, unknown even to him, he said, people often called him Snuffy. Of course, in those days, we didn't dress lieutenants by their first name, but later we did. And he was always called Snuffy, too, and there was always confusion whether somebody was talking about Snuffy Smith or Snuffy Dordan. But anyway, he had that name, and he was down there. There were other people that I knew. Well, of course, as you can imagine, everybody was keen to find out who his flight instructor would be. Now, this time we were transferring to an AT-6. It was a North American low-wing monoplane, all metal, with a good many more horsepower than the BT-13, but not much heavier, which meant that it was faster. It had one machine gun in the nose, or someplace. It had a retractable landing gear and was, again, a tandem cockpit-type arrangement. Except the big difference was that this time, unlike primary flying school and unlike basic flying school, the student always rode in the front and the instructor always rode behind. The instructor didn't do much flying. If he flew with you, but he didn't do much to flying himself. These airplanes had flaps on them, of course, but these were hydraulic flaps and were very easy to raise and lower. Also had something that was entirely new to all of us, was a constant speed propeller. And that took a bit of getting used to. You had to. So we started placing a lot of reliance on an instrument in the cockpit called the manifold pressure gauge. And that was a new thing for us. Well, I got assigned to an instructor by the name of Lieutenant Alley, A-L-L-E-Y, Jack Alley, Black Jack Alley, some people called him, though some people didn't include his students. He was, vaguely speaking, perhaps an ugly sort of looking man. I don't really think he was ugly, but again, he was a kind of earnest, good-looking Ernest Borgnine type, black hair, black eyes, and the sort who, 5 minutes after he'd finished shaving, looked like he needed another shave. And he was rather grim looking, it seemed to me. It didn't take very long to find out he was anything but grim, that was a Freudian slip if I ever made one, because he did grin a lot. He was not grim ever, perhaps, that I can remember. I forget who else was with me as his student, but I do remember that there was a tall, slim, blonde youth from the northern United States somewhere named Bill Fawcett, and extremely nice young man. Looked a bit like a goat or something, and had no doubt been a goat or a fawn or a deer or antelope or something in a former life. I might interject at this point that once at the end of our training with Lieutenant Alley, I remember Lieutenant Alley saying to Fawcett, Fawcett, he said, I don't say this to many people, but I've done a lot of flying in my time, and I have never in my entire life flown with a man who flies as smoothly as you do. And I expect, from what little I know about it, he was dead right. Fawcett was good. We had another man in our flight, a very tall, gangly, and quite ugly young man, and a very nice one too, I might say, who is well known in many circles these days, and has been for many years. I'm trying to think of his name. Well, his name was Charlie Engelhard, and his father owned an outfit that I can't readily describe. My brother Jack knows what this outfit is, but they deal in, I guess, precious and semi-precious metals, or rare metals, or something. Anyway, Charlie Engelhard now owns and runs that company, but when he was an aviation cadet, Charlie Engelhard, flew with me at Spence Field, and I remember one night in the barracks when Charlie said, my father's got a dollar for every goddamn nail in this barracks. His father probably had $5 for every goddamn nail in that barracks, for that matter. And Charlie himself was the envy of many because he had a Lincoln Continental. I was too ignorant and naive in those days to know anything about a Lincoln Continental one way or the other, but Charlie had one, and he drove it around, and I remember Lieutenant Alley one morning came down to the flight line, and he was briefing us on the day's work, and he said, I was downtown yesterday, and he said, I saw this big, long car come down the street. I was standing on the corner, And the car started turning the corner around right where I was, and he said it was so long it took it about 5 minutes before the last of that car got around the corner. And I looked inside, and there was one of my goddamn cadets, old Charlie Englehart, here. I remember that. I didn't know Charlie very well, but he was very nice. I remember that. And, of course, you couldn't help but know people somewhat if you had the same flight instructor. A few minutes ago, I said that one of the other students of Lieutenant Alley was Bill Fawcett, and that's not so. Bill Fawcett was the name of one of the cadets, but the guy that I meant to name, his name was Archie Doty, D-O-T-Y, from Connecticut. Otherwise, he fit the description that I recently gave of Bill Fawcett. Might be a good a time as any to relate here a very embarrassing episode which took place in connection with Archie Doty. On on instrument flying, often we would practice instrument flying in the air, and what you would do, instead of having an instructor with you for practice purposes, you would go up with another student. And the one who was going to practice instruments would ride in the back seat, and you would fly the airplane and go through prescribed procedures. But you had to have somebody with you, of course. Otherwise, there's no way to keep two airplanes from flying together if there wasn't somebody there who could keep his eyes out for other traffic. And I went up one day and was the pilot, and Archie Doty was in the back seat to practice instruments. And we went up and practiced. He practiced. And when the time came to come back and land, I did that. But somehow, these things seem to happen every now and then, and how this happened, I don't quite know, because I'd had quite a bit of time in that airplane by then. But the long and short of it was that I landed much too high, and the airplane fell to the ground with a terrible whoomp, and it was an absolute miracle it didn't just punch the landing gear right up through the wings. But it didn't. Nothing happened at all, but I was so chagrined and embarrassed to have done this thing in second place with, of all people, in the back seat, Archie Doty. It just killed me. And furthermore, it was so bad that I was sure I was going to get in trouble over this. Well, I suppose I could have gotten in trouble over it, but I didn't. The only thing that happened at all was the next morning when we assembled there and before Blackjack Alley, and he stood there eyeing us up and down for a while with a grin on his face, and finally said, "And then I learned here," he said, "I learned that one of my cadets yesterday made such a pancake landing that the man in the control tower had his foot on the alarm switch. Because he thought it was going to be a crash." And I don't suppose any of you know who that was. And of course I looked sheepish and all, and that's the last I heard of it. But it was an incident which has embarrassed me to this day. I could do very well with not remembering it anymore. We had a good deal of fun at Spence Field. We had real airplanes, and we were doing real things with them. More formation flying, more night flying, more navigation. And we were being treated like grown-ups, pretty much. And it was, of course, you have to remember, furthermore, it was the month of May, and it was the weather was beautiful. And we would go off in the afternoon sometimes to a nearby river and go swimming with local kids. One weekend, somebody probably Elliot Black, I don't remember, but I expect it was, took me and some other people who was with us, I don't know, Joe Hensler, I'm sure, was one. Anyway, he drove us down to a place in the panhandle of Florida, and not that far away, in miles, called Wakulla Springs. And that was in a sort of a resort place, and they had this extraordinary spring. It was like a hole in the ground, so deep you couldn't see the bottom, and very large in diameter, 30 feet across, perhaps. I was told at one time the largest spring in the United States. I don't know whether it was or not, but it was very beautiful, and the water that came out of the spring was warm and absolutely clear. Well, we arrived there early in the evening or late in the afternoon or something like that, and I don't know what we thought was going to happen, but the place was full. It was Saturday night, furthermore. Well, there again, the civilians in those days went to any length to do things for servicemen, and the manager of the hotel, which was full, set up some cots in his private office, and we spent the night sleeping on those cots in his private office. And we spent much of the next day there swimming and lying in the sun and having an absolutely wonderful time. One of the odd things about that place was, I was struck by it at the time and I've never forgotten it, was that at the lower end, this water came up through the spring and flowed away in a large creek or small river somewhere. But at the lower end, at the exit end of this thing, there were dozens, or something like that, of alligators. And they didn't pay a bit of attention to the swimmers, and people said they didn't like the boats, and they didn't like the swimmers, and they did their best to stay as far away from them as they conveniently could. But you'd be swimming in the spring all over around there, and surrounded by trees and bushes and stuff. But down there at the far end, you could see those alligators just lying in the sun, doing nothing, but they didn't pay any attention to us. And I don't think anybody was sorry for that. At some point in our training, we were supposed to get a few hours of training in something called basic combat. Well, I don't know what it was, but it consisted of going up in two airplanes, your instructor in one, you in the other, and each one of you trying to outturn the other or outmaneuver him and get on his tail. It was a great deal of fun, needless to say. And I went up for my stint at this thing with Lieutenant Alley. But Lieutenant Alley made the fatal mistake. It wasn't fatal, of course, but made the mistake of taking a friend of his with him in the back seat. And what that amounted to was that his airplane was therefore heavier than mine was, and I beat him every time. There was nothing he could do. And we kept this up for an hour or so, but I just ended up on his tail constantly. And he was rather chagrined about this, and he said later, he said, well, that'll teach me. I'm never going to do that again with a passenger in the back seat. And probably he didn't either. Lieutenant Alley taught me a valuable lesson once. We had to do at one time a triangular navigation flight on instruments, which meant you flew from Spence Field to some point and to some town 30, 40 miles away, and then to another town 30, 40 miles away, and then back on a triangular course to Spence Field. But you had to do this on instruments. which meant you were in the back seat and under the hood, as the saying is. I suppose I was in the back seat, I don't know. I think so. Doesn't make any difference about that. You couldn't see out. Well, it happened to be a hot May day, and the air was rough as could be. We were bounced all over the place. And, of course, I had laid out my thing, what you do. You measure the different distance between the points you're going to and what the compass course is you must fly and how long it's going to take you. And when you reach point number one, of course, you can't see whether you've gotten there or not. But you turn to the next compass heading and fly the prescribed length of time, which you were the one figured this out. So if it's wrong, you are one's going to have to pay for it. And then you get to the second town again. The time is up. You just turn and hope you were somewhere near that place and get back. Well, as I said, on this day, the air was extremely rough. And the compass just went all over the place in the cockpit.